from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 379, recorded live Thursday, July 4th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, makers of GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Dan Bricklin about the future and past of computing.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I've got with me today Dan Bricklin, often referred to as the father of the spreadsheet. And you've seen him before, actually, on This Developer's Life. I'm happy to have you here, sir. How are you?
I'm doing really well.
Kind of a sad couple of days here. You probably noticed that Douglas Engelbart passed away.
Yeah, I just saw that and started watching some of the old videos. And I looked at old pictures. I found an old picture of me with him and Philippe Kahn and Bob Metcalf.
Wow.
In 1999. But then I saw that Mark Bernstein posted a picture of Ted Nelson with him and Aaron Schwartz.
Wow.
Which was really cool. Because Ted also helped popularize to the next generation hypertext.
Yeah, these are the kind of the history of computing people that I don't think the average Joe knows the names of. Like, you know, people don't even know Tim Berners-Lee, but they, you know, probably couldn't ask 100 people and have them tell you who Douglas Engelbart was.
No, on the other hand, they all know what a mouse is.
Exactly. And
yeah, he's the one who got the first one made and had reasons and invented the reasons why we would want it.
Well, and when I was watching, because I think that everyone, if you don't know who Douglas Engelbart is, go and do the Googling and look it up. But be sure to watch the Mother of All Demos. It's up on YouTube. This was in 1968, and he was doing stuff, and I was in my mind trying to do the same thing with Word, with Microsoft Word, and I'm watching him do some editing stuff, and I'm like, gosh, it's 2013, and I'm not actually sure how to do that in Word.
Yeah, I mean, he's collapsing, like, you know, like doing outlining, and he's the links, and he's doing, real-time video conferencing, and he demoed all this live.
Yeah. He did it live in 1968. He was doing, you know, line numbering, and he had on a headset. I mean, if it wasn't in black and white, he could have been demoing the latest version of Windows. It just happened to be all text and in black and white. It was really quite sophisticated. The mouse was extremely smooth.
Yeah, well, the fact that they had light pens before and stuff like that, but it wasn't like that. And, you know, they had the mouse. They showed two people using the mouse simultaneously, one in one room and one, you know, at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
He was inspired by Vannevar Bush before. I mean, each person's inspired, and then he inspired others like Ted Nelson, who wrote the book Computer Lib, that inspired others like Dave Weiner,
mm-hmm.
and who inspired a lot of people who got things that we have today that now inspire the people who think they're inventing it all.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the video, but he has his mouse in the right hand, he has his keyboard, then he has some kind of a cording hotkey. What is that on the left there?
He was experimenting with different type of input devices, and the mouse was one of his experiments. But he had the cord keyboard, where basically you would push, you could use multiple fingers and push one button to, you know, in different cords, and that was ways of being able to type into the computer. He had what that, a cord keyboard, a mouse, and a real keyboard. And he was experimenting with different forms of input.
Do you think that that is representative of like I've got a natural keyboard in front of me with some hotkeys on top. I've got the function keys, which have now been standardized, but I don't spend a lot of time other than using modifiers like Control Shift and Alt. There's not a lot of cording in my life.
I guess it turned out that it was, while people could learn it, it wasn't something people could come up with, but they were experimenting in those days. They were inventing the things that we take for granted and we think is normal. So that's why everybody is making such a big deal about his life,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, somebody comes up with this stuff for the first time and does the experimentation and throws out, and then eventually throw out the stuff that doesn't catch on.
Mm-hmm.
Or we, later on, we find out that maybe now it's okay to do that.
The that level of historical context. I mean, I know he was in his late 80s when he passed away a couple of days ago, but he must be just watching these things and both being excited that they have reached ubiquity, but also saying, gosh, 40 years and nothing really interesting has happened.
His mouse is an idea that we point to all the time when you say, well, how long did it take? You know, why don't people use this great new thing right away? Why don't they get it? I mean, look how long it took them to get Twitter or blogging. Remember, they made fun of blogging back in 2004 at the Democratic National Convention. They were making fun of bloggers. And of course, now, you know, Twitter, we'll forget about that. But we look at the mouse and we say, the mouse was shown publicly in 1968. And then it wasn't until 1984. That it got onto a machine that actually we still have with us today that is popular. There were other mouse, you know, the Alto and the Star and stuff like that used the mouse, but Lisa, but it wasn't until 1984 with the Macintosh that it started to come in the normal, into normal people's consciousness. Now, of course, you know, and then even after 84, it wasn't until what, like Windows 90, whatever, 95 or whatever, that it was like really well accepted in all of computingdom and person. That's a long time.
It is a long time.
Yeah, it's we're talking about 20, 30 years.
I remember trying to teach my family how to right click and how to double click. Like there used to be tutorials on how to successfully double click because it's just not intuitive.
Well, that's why we need people learning from others. I think it was in a Markov's article in the Times that mentioned the first mouse had as many buttons as he could fit on it. Obviously, with this cord thing, he was into thinking of multiple buttons. It had three buttons on it. And that's what they used for a while. They, you know, had like a select button in it. And then, you know, Jobs came in and said, no, let's make it simple. We'll just have one button because then you can't push the wrong button. Of course, then they had to come up with the equivalent of cording with double clicking, clicking and holding.
Yeah.
And then, you know, holding down a key and clicking, or holding down another key and clicking. So maybe he wasn't so wrong, but, you know, each of us add our own, as Jobs add his stuff to it and others add to it, and we end up with what we have today.
I was, my wife was sorting through thousands of photographs to put together a baby book for my oldest son yesterday. And I was watching her do it. I was kind of watching in a detached way because wives, I have found, don't like it if you snatch the mouse from them and show them how to use something. And even though she's a highly educated and very successful person in finance and has an advanced degree, she was struggling just to have two windows open and have them appropriately sized. And then rather than using the scroll wheel that her finger was resting on, she was choosing to go down and pick the little tiny 8-pixel by 8-pixel down arrow to scroll down. And I thought, gosh, I thought this was a solved problem. We can snap two windows together like Norton Commander and we can roll with her. And I kept showing her the rolly wheel and she says, that doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I mean, especially since some apps it works in and some it doesn't. And of course, Apple made it go upside down. But sometimes you'll just skip right ahead, like the touch. But then if, you know, when the original Surface, Microsoft Surface, the one that was huge, you know, there was a table, and they were doing sorting of pictures with it, you could see how that would work. And now with things like the Dell XPS 27, that huge, you know, and you can sort of fold it down, or the Lenovo and others that you can put on the desk, we now can actually do the sorting of the pictures that way, which is more natural.
It is very natural. A flicking motion to just say over there.
Put this over here, drag this over here. Let's juxtapose these together, put that in a pile with the big screens. You know, maybe the scroll wheel wasn't the natural thing.
Yeah.
But it also gets into simplicity. A lot of people like to learn a few tools and use them. People like to be able to say, I have this general purpose thing I know how to use, and it does all these things for me. It's why they'll use, in the old days, the accountants would learn a spreadsheet and they would do word processing in it because they don't want to learn a word processor. They already knew the spreadsheet and they had this one tool that was good enough for them. Sometimes don't bother me with it. When you're a programmer, programmers who really get into the tools, you want to have what Engelbart had, the cord. that you can, oh, if you do what we call used to call it command shift Coke bottle, you know, you would push all this, you would have all these modifier keys to use Emacs or whatever. And now, of course, you're showing off that stuff when you're showing off the IDEs, you know, like Visual Studio. A programmer learns to have all these tools. While most people were used to saying, well, you know, a hammer, a screwdriver, and, you know, a vice grip is good enough for me. While, you know, a person who really needs their tools probably has boxes, huge, you know, tool chest with many, just the right tool for the right thing. And that's an interesting jump. I mean, I watch people who actually can dream almost an Emacs, you know, and be able to, you know, hitting the shifts and whatever. I find it sometimes easier just to retype because I type fast enough mm-hmm. rather than try to say, well, what is, you know, what's the control thing for backing up two words and go halfway and, you know, so it's different thinking for different people. And we have to remember that different people do think different ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, you wrote a famous essay called Why Johnny Can't Program, where you kind of explore those things. And I was an adjunct professor at a state school teaching software engineering, and I had to go to the dean and say, there's a particular fella who's just taken my class, and I just, you know, I want him to be successful, but I don't think he should be a programmer. And let me rephrase. It wasn't that I don't think he should be. I don't think he could be successful because I just simply don't think his brain is wired that way.
And that's the way, just like, you know, I can't compose good music. My brain just isn't.
So why is it that in intellectual pursuits like programming, one would say something like, I don't think you should be a programmer. Like, well, I'm going to be a programmer and you watch me, right? Through sheer force of will. I don't think any force of will is going to make me Mozart.
Right. Michael Jordan or, you know, Michael Jordan couldn't play baseball at the level of other people, right? And he's Michael Jordan.
He's probably pretty disappointed.
That was a very interesting example there, you know, of, you know, people who have incredible will still can't necessarily do it, but sometimes you can. It's programmers. Well, there's something magic about programmers to people. They, you know, in the old days, being a programmer was such an unusual skill that they would put up with all sorts of personality strangeness that they wouldn't put up in other parts of the same business because mm-hmm. They were so desperate for it, which, of course, led to advantages that people who had those personality traits were now able to get very well-paying jobs that couldn't before. And not that everybody had those, but it meant that if you had those traits, this is a job you could get.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were able to program at all, you know, people thought that you were great. Where some tools started coming in that made it possible for other types of people to be able to program. And then it being a programmer, you could be more likely to be more normal.
Do you think those personality types have set us up such that with programmers, and I believe that it's the case that there's a programmer glass ceiling. Like if you're at a company that is run by business people and you are not the CTO, there's only so much money you're going to make as a programmer, even as programmer number one, because ultimately the CEO and the CXO signs the checks. Isn't that historical? Like it's because we used to be weird and they.
Well, no, it may be negotiating and other. You know, about the position. On the other hand, you know that the head of development or whatever has in their, you know, their pocket, so to speak, not, I mean, as protection for themselves, they know who the super programmer is.
Mm.
And if they move to another company, they would make sure that they brought that person along. It's, you know, like, you know, I remember there was a Steven Seagal movie where the head of, the admiral or whatever, had this Navy SEAL he kept with him all the time.
Right.
He knew that's what he needed.
Yeah.
And, you know, the old samurai, having the right, you know, you hire the right samurai to be there with you. I'm sure it's the same, but the pay and the people outside don't need it. And often the programmer, you know, doesn't push for it, but some do. And we just don't see those. That would not be in the worlds that many of us are in.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that programming should be mysterious, or do you think that there is a room for these modern, you know, like text boxes over data? That's a line of business app, right? It's just a regular old real business app, like your SAPs and your Salesforces. Should I, a programmer, be writing those? Or should my wife, someone who has a deep understanding of business, be writing those?
Well, it depends on what the application is. I mean, I think that it's people who are good at what's needed for the particular application should write it. Mm-hmm. So you would want somebody who knows business using a spreadsheet to do business stuff, rather than somebody who doesn't know business, either using a spreadsheet or writing it in C or something like that, mm-hmm. who doesn't understand the problem. So for a lot of businessy stuff, you want a domain expert. For games, you want somebody who has a feel for both the gaming, you know, and to make it, you know, and you want somebody who has the feel for the sound, the scene, a feel for the visuals, as well as somebody who has a feel for how to make it work real fast and feel good. So there's different skills demanded by the particular application. So if you're just talking about filling in forms, and if it's rare, it's not used too much, and it's used by the same people who know it, you can get by with, well, the people who need it might as well build it themselves if they can. That's why things like the spreadsheet became so popular. Mm-hmm. Think of, initially, programming was done by, you know, these special people who were like, what, math PhDs, they were women initially. And it was thought, they didn't realize where the people who built the computers were not considered the special people, and the, you know, the people who programmed weren't as special in the old days. And then the people who built it were, and the programmers weren't, and then the programmers were. And, but then, you know, because the programming was in machine language, and then they invented Fortran, and scientists could write in something that was kind of mathematical, and mathematicians could write in a sort of mathematical language and get things done. And, you know, computers, the use of computers took off a lot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the web took off when it was, you could just take Microsoft Word and push a button and get HTML out of it.
Lousy HTML, but in HTML indeed.
Yes. Now, we as programmers knew how lousy. Oh, boy, we look down on that. Look how verbose. Look how it takes twice as long to download on a, you know. On the other hand, people said, yeah. Here's an example that I remember is, I worked in word processing, very early screen-based word processing back in the mid-70s. And we were very much consumed by letter quality printing. We wanted it to look as good as a letter typed on a good typewriter. And, you know, dot matrix printers just didn't do it. And so we had daisy wheel printers. And when I was at DEC Digital, we had to teach the guys at Diablo about how to do a better printer to make it work better. And so we were so proud. And then what did people end up doing? You know, then there's the laser printer, you know, the laser jet. Wow. It looks just like a typewriter and or typeset. And then people threw it in fax machines and it looked like a dot matrix printer again. They didn't care.
Yeah.
They cared about, I mean, they originally did, but it was more important for them to get it there in time, you know, to get it there immediately. There were some other things that were more important to them about the problem. And what we thought was important suddenly was really secondary to them. So that's the same thing. I mean, you know, we care about, you know, well-crafted code and all that, which does matter for certain things, mm-hmm. but doesn't always, especially if you have to get it programmed quick. I mean,
yeah.
Programs that are available after they're needed is not a good thing. If you have a sales, you're going to have a sales campaign and you want to support your salespeople with programs for it, having it the week after the sales campaign is over because the programmers were still working on it is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you want to, you know, how long it takes to get it done and how good it looks and all that. The fact it can't win an award, doesn't matter. There were other things that were more important.
Well, solving the problem matters, right? I mean, I know that last year in Japan, they sold 2 million fax machines. Like the world has left fax machines behind except Japan.
Yeah, because of their language, it still has its advantages for handwritten stuff.
Yeah, they value the fax machine. They value the paper, the physicality of it, and the immediacy of it.
And the last few years I've been doing programming on the iPad, and I did a note-taking program called Notetaker HD. And there people were doing handwritten notes. And it initially was very popular among medical students. And that surprised me. You know, all sorts of others later on, but when I allowed you to mark up PDF files, and then all sorts of people were interested in it. But medical students are taking notes that you can't type. And they're drawing, and they're doing, you know, and they're doing chemistry, and they're doing this and that. And if they wanted to use computers, they needed handwritten. And it was opened up by having the ability to do handwriting into kept as handwriting into the iPad,
mm-hmm.
Which is really cool. And there are all sorts of areas like that where, we suddenly find out that computing works for it when we have the right equipment. The fax worked for people who want paper in, paper out, it's kind of easier sometimes than scanning to a PDF, emailing the PDF, and then printing in the PDF.
How did your kind of movement into mobile work out for you? I know you were very excited about NoteTaker HD.
I was, and for good reason. It did very well. In 2011, I think at the end of the year, Apple shows how well apps did, and it was in the top 50, as I recall, of all paid iPad apps.
Wow.
That's pretty good. I made a real good living as a programmer, being an iPad developer. I'm still making money off of it.
Mm-hmm. And is it done?
Oh, yeah. Well, done. No, you constantly have to upgrade it. The last time I upgraded it was, I think, in November.
Mm-hmm.
I've been busy with some other things since, so I haven't done much more work on it. I have a lot of partially done things. Done some other iOS stuff since. But with iOS 7, if I have to upgrade it to do special support for iOS 7 because it's incompatible, I'll go back to programming it. I mean, I've got a lot of users who use it every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still doing tech support for it. You know, I get $3.50 after Apple takes their cut,
mm-hmm.
bucks. And yet, I'll be on the phone or, do email and whatever.
So you use it all the time. It's a fundamental part of your workflow.
When I'm at conferences and stuff, it's how I take my notes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mainly coding and stuff, so I don't need that
mm-hmm.
much. And actually I'm doing a lot of video and things. That's one of the interesting things about in mobile, you do video is the way you show it. I mean, you have to sort of demo a lot. We don't have tool tips at this point. Though Samsung is starting to show the ability to do that on theirs. So when you do your demonstrations and your videos, people expect to watch a video, learn it on the spot, and then be able to use the application. You have to learn how to be able to shoot that and all, and cameras and good sound and stuff like that to be able to do those.
Now, you're certainly still bullish on mobile, right? I mean, you just recently joined Alpha Software as their CTO. That seems like I just assumed that you would be independent. You'd want to do your own thing. I know you're so excited about mobile, and you're still, of course, going to do NoteTaker HD, but why join a company?
Well, the company is, first of all, they're friends of mine that I've known for many years who founded the company and run it. And I used to run my business on one of their older products way back when, Alpha 4. It was a product for a database. It's a database, it's a pre-access product. And it was a real easy to use but very powerful system. And even though I was coding in C and assembler and selling my old Dan Bricklin's demo program, I did all my invoicing and, shipping labels and all that. I did that with Alpha because it was aimed for somebody who wanted to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to now, and I was looking, people are using NoteTaker HD to fill out intake forms for doctors and stuff. When the patients come in, they would take a PDF and mark it up and, check off this and that. And then the receptionist types it in, whatever. But realize that data input is a big thing, and data businesses really want to use the tablets and the mobile devices for business applications of transactions and data acquisition,
mm-hmm.
just for reading. I mean, it's not just a data consumption device. And I said, let's get into that. And I can build a thing with this. Wait, then I have to do the back end. I want to connect to a database. I'm going to have to build a report generator because sometimes you want to actually produce reports. And I'm going to have to do, wow, that's a lot of work. And then I saw the guys at Alpha, they have that already. I said, you're doing that. And I had already felt that if you want to do something, it's got to run everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you can do it with HTML5, that would be really good. I had done a lot of work when I was doing SocialCalc, which is a JavaScript spreadsheet a few years ago. I knew how you could make some really good things in JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
The modern JavaScript with the modern browsers are even better. So I've been playing with that, with trying to put my spreadsheet on a tablet and to, oh, there are neat UIs you can do. I should experiment here. And it turned out that the alpha people, they had been going the same direction. They had been retooling their system that was web-based to be HTML5-based for the mobile stuff, mm-hmm. which, et cetera. So it's like, well, you're already doing all this work. Why don't I just join you and do some of the innovation on the new stuff without having to build all those things in the back end? Plus, I don't have to worry about supporting servers and stuff. So that's why I did that. Plus, I've been working alone for a long time, and it was time to work with some other people.
Mm-hmm. Is this code generation, or is it a whole language, and then it generates HTML? Does it hide the HTML from you?
Yes and no. The alpha way of doing things, the way the style that their applications have always been, is that you develop in a system that's like property sheet based. You know, like in Visual Basic, when you put in a control, you do everything by putting all the properties. You say, mm-hmm. I want to do this wide, whatever. And then if you need to code something like, on this event, do this, you can drop into language. What they do is they have all the common cases already built in or on drop-down lists. So the common cases are all there. But at any point, you can drop in and actually code in CSS directly, code in JavaScript directly, code in SQL directly, in SQL to connect to your SQL backend stuff, because they also have server-side stuff. You can connect in .NET languages if you want on the server side, or use their automatically created stuff. And you can go back and forth between the two. So they're producing the JavaScript for the client,
mm-hmm.
and stuff to run on the server. But at any point, you can look at the source. At any point, you can use their stuff. And I like that. It gives you the power, but you don't have to know it. So what a lot of people do who are using it is they may or may not know the language HTML and JavaScript very well, but they can get what they need built. And with a little bit of help, they, you know, maybe being a script kiddie who copies in something from somebody else, they can get some very powerful things. So, for example, one user, one person who's developing apps with it, is she does search engine optimization. She does that for others, and she needed a workflow management system, which she built in Alpha. And she used CSS themes that she got off the web and whatever. But she wanted to use Dropbox for sharing data with her clients. So somebody else she contacted who knew Alpha built the JavaScript for her to integrate it into Dropbox. But she could do all the other stuff, and all the filtering and the database management was all done through Alpha. And that's kind of cool, because she really isn't a coder per se, but she built a whole system out of it. But she has some really sophisticated code that she got from somebody else that she knows how to put in. And so it's a relatively high level. It's for people who you still have to learn it. I mean, it's not like, blogging with Blogger. You could just use it and it sort of, there wasn't that much to learn.
Right.
To learn.
Well, it sounds like Excel or Access or any of the,
In fact, people who use Access love it, because what they say is, oh, Access doesn't do well when it comes to the web.
Mm-hmm.
And Access doesn't do well when it comes to mobile. But what am I going to do? I think in terms of tables, the SQL tables.
Right.
In terms of tables, what do I do? And I know VBA. It turns out that, you know, a lot of the stuff, if you want, in Alpha uses a basic variant for some of the stuff, if you want.
It seems like JavaScript and HTML5 have just in the last 6 months to a year reached that point where we've really got a nice virtual machine on which we can build, you know, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are a couple things. One is that the virtual machine's been good enough that we can do incredible things, but they also, CSS got access to the GPU, the graphics processing unit, so that they're transforms. So the smooth things we're used to, so they can follow your finger, and do the morphing from one thing to another that we're used to on the mobile platforms and even on the desktop platforms that help you keep context. That's now done in hardware by CSS transforms and CSS animation. And that's really cool. So now it's powerful enough to be able to do a lot of the user interface touches that you would think could only be done natively beforehand. Yeah, so thank God we're there.
That tension between the native apps and the HTML-based applications kind of continues to go back and forth, right? Just as we think something's not possible in HTML, we pull it off.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing is that when you listen to what some of the HTML, the people who are building the browser say, well, you know, I needed such and such, so I modified the language. We got together, we modified the language and put in this. We needed this faster, so we added that as a feature. You know, it's each time. It's, remember in the old days with Microsoft, people would say, well, Microsoft does this, but they can't do that. And apparently that became the number one requirement within Microsoft to build for the next release. Because that's how it looked from the outside. And it's the same thing with these browser developers. And luckily there are multiple of them who work well together, it looks like. I saw an interview you did with one of them, how they work well with their competition and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, but they're all like, yeah, they all say JavaScript can't do it. Well, we'll show them. And that's been cool. But go back to the thing about the letter quality printing versus the fact. I'll use a spreadsheet rather than a real program done with it. You know, a lot of people are willing to make it not look as good. I mean, we use the web. If you look at how bad the web looked when it started and started taking over, compared to native apps, the web versus AT&T Interchange or AOL or CompuServe, it didn't look anywhere near as good.
Mm-hmm.
But it got the job done by regular people. So that's the same thing here with HTML and JavaScript and CSS.
Mm-hmm.
It gets the job done. Oh, except for one thing. It gets the job done enough, and perhaps the native may be better, but we don't care because we'd rather have the project done. It's more important to get it done. The thing is that even for Apple, and if you look on iOS and Android and all over the place, they use web views, a program thing, which is basically a little web browser inside the app for presenting text and things, because it's really hard to do the things you do with HTML real easily with text.
Yeah.
And so they punt and they drop into web views inside of the applications to be able to do things. So HTML is even better there, and they have to admit it.
Yeah, that convenience of a really dynamic generated user interface on every platform, Android, iOS, Windows Phone, they drop in a web view and they go. And you can tell, as a technologist, you can tell. I don't think the users know.
But if there's phone gap. A lot of people where phone gap is a system that connects the web view to the outside in a standard way so that you can write once in HTML, JavaScript, and CSS, and deploy that, and it will run on all sorts of systems, on even BlackBerries and, you know, Windows Phone and iOS and Android, and be able to access hardware things that haven't been exposed yet in JavaScript. And The write once, write run everywhere matters because of the bring your own device. You know, people, they may want an Android device or the company, you know, or they also want it to be on iOS, or you want. So writing in HTML and JavaScript means that you can run on all sorts of devices. It's why the iPhone and iPad were successful in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, because it could run the browser. You know, they were able to put a browser that was just as good as any other browser.
Well, I think the browser on a mobile phone, on a good mobile phone, is almost as good as a lot of operating systems.
There's Firefox OS coming up that is a whole operating system.
Indeed.
Yeah. So that's why, you know, that's one reason I was willing to join Alpha, because I saw they were going this way of saying, let's make the target be this HTML5. You can build apps that you'll be able to just, you know, you can run standalone native on the machine. You can serve them up, you know, off of a server. to be able to get it, which you need to do anyway when you're getting live data all the time, mm-hmm. That rather than saying, no, we're going to generate native code and we're going to have to follow all the different SDKs as they advance.
Cool. Well, we can learn about all of this stuff up on your blog. You've talked about why alpha is important and what you're doing in that space and why you think that bridging the mobile apps, touch apps, and the web are important. And listeners can check you out at Dan B on Twitter. And I would also encourage them to check out the episode of This Developer's Life that we did with you last year, which I think was very well received as well.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Thanks so much for talking to me today.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.